This is Divorce Happy Hour, a show about divorce and issues people face going through divorce. Your co-hosts are Christina Previtt and John Knocklinger. For more information about the show and to connect with us, head over to divorcehappyhour.com. And now, on to today's show.
Hey, everybody. I am joining you today with my good friend, Anju Chusani. We're doing sort of an impromptu Divorce Happy Hour live. As you may know, we go live every Friday at 12:30. And today I wanted to invite a special guest, Anju, to talk about mediation. Anju is the founder of Divorce with Dignity Mediation Services. Her Wharton MBA and her extensive experience working in the financial world make her uniquely qualified to conduct complex economic mediations, which she's been doing since 1997. And also included in that is divorce and family law, among other things. So welcome, Anju.
Hey, thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
It's nice to have you. And anybody who has been practicing family law in New Jersey for even a minute has probably come across your name at some point. You know, you've been, as I said, a mediator for some time. And I think you're one of the go-to people on the short list for mediation in family law.
Well, that's so, when you stay in the business long enough, right, you get, you know, you have staying power, so people know your name, and there aren't many Anjus in the mediation world.
That's right. But you know what? I think also the reason is because you do a good job. You know, people know that when they send a mediation case to you, that they know that you're going to be thorough, that you're going to do a good job, you know, that you're providing a wonderful service to the parties. And, you know, the best compliment you can ever get, right, is a referral, because people are trusting you to do the work and do it well. So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what your experience has been doing mediation, because you have been doing it for a bit, and, you know, how maybe your practice has changed over time. So if you can, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. Like, you know, do you have sort of a philosophy in the way that you approach mediation and divorce cases?
Sure. So when I started in 1997, people found mediators through referrals and through the Yellow Pages, right? So when I was starting my practice, I go through all these different Yellow Pages and see who's available. There is no internet. So people will send you a brochure in a plain envelope, but you don't really know a lot about how people market, how their name gets out. So you're kind of solo flying, trying to figure out how to start a practice. So when I started my practice, there wasn't websites, but there was a DivorceNet and DivorceSource were the first two kind of web pages that you could get listed on. And so that's where I started. And then I volunteered in Hudson in family court for nearly a year. For about 3 months, I went in full time. People thought I worked in the court. And then I was there once a week. And I mediated a lot of parenting, because that's what you're mediating in court. And that's how I kind of got started before I had private clients, just volunteering. And when I wasn't volunteering, I was sitting in the courtroom and just watching motions. And so that was really helpful. Like, you know, I come from a corporate background. I didn't have kind of that legal exposure.
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting how you ended up even doing this line of work anyway, because you're, you know, we think of you as sort of the finance person. So if you don't mind sharing how this all came to be.
Well, I always say, I'm so lucky I didn't have a brain tumor, because I probably would have become a neurosurgeon. But I got divorced in 1994 and went through mediation and thought it was a great process. Didn't particularly feel like the mediator we went to was appropriate for us, because they were a social worker, didn't have a strong financial background. And we didn't have children, but we had a lot of complex financial issues. We had restricted stock. We had stock options. We had two homes. One was underwater. And we ended up sitting down with our accountant to work out the numbers, because we needed a numbers person. And as we're doing this, well, I'm thinking, yeah, I could be doing this. And I didn't quit my day job. That was in 94. But in 97, I got a buyout from my employer, JP Morgan. And I looked around and thought, what am I going to do? And they said, well, you know, you can keep interviewing for another job here. And I took the mediation training in New York with Ken Newman and his group, the Family and Divorce Mediation Center. And that's how I started. At the same time, I had wanted to have a child. And so I said, this is a good time to have a child, start my practice. And hey, if this doesn't work, I'll go back. I'll go back to corporate. I gave myself 2 years. Right? If this wasn't working in 2 years, it's like any other business. It's not working in 2 years. You've got to change direction. You can't keep going in a direction that's not working. But I think that there's every mediator has a unique selling proposition, my philosophy. And so you've got to find yours, right? I can't tell you that I'm an expert on family conflict, right? It doesn't jive with being an MBA. But if I tell you that I understand complex financial issues, that's consistent. So you've got to sell something that works for you. And my philosophy is the clients have the absolute right to self-determination, that they need to be in control. I create a process, but it's their solution. But they shouldn't make decisions without information. So for instance, you have a teacher and a police officer, and they come in and they tell me, well, I'm going to keep my pension. We're just going to keep our own pensions. I said, you can waive whatever you want, but you need to know the value. It doesn't cost much to get a pension value, get it valued, see what the present values are. And then if you want to waive, each keep your own, keep your own. But my idea is that you need to make informed decisions. And that drives some clients crazy. They don't want to bring in documents. They don't want to get valuations. And I keep pushing. I'm like a dog with a bone. Please, you know, get the documents. It's up to you. It's your ultimate resolution, but it's my process.
So it's sort of like, you know, some form of discovery that you're doing.
Totally. It's totally takes the place of discovery, but it's not 10 years worth of bank statements, 3 years worth of bank statements where you explain every expenditure over 500. I'm asking for your most recent statements. And if you want to do more, you can certainly do more. But every time you ask for a document, someone's going to review it. And I often wonder, and maybe Christina, you can tell me this, when you ask for 3 years worth of bank statements, do you go through 3 years worth of bank statements?
There really has to be a reason that I'm asking for it. I don't just reflexively ask for that, because I think sometimes it just can be a waste of time. But I counsel the client about, you know, the value of getting discovery, maybe that's bank statements, and if that's important to them. I also try to emphasize to them that if you want to investigate any of the finances, now is the time. Because if you are just in a hurry and you just want to get this done because it's excruciating, and then a year goes by and you're like, you know what, I really should have gone through all those things, it's too late. You're not going to be able to do it later. So if there are questions that you need answered now about your finances, now's the time. And some people do feel the need to go through all the bank statements and some don't. I do not personally go through them unless there's something specific that I'm looking for. You know, if there's an issue of someone's income and we think maybe there's cash deposits, then I will look through there. You know, if there's a specific transaction that's in question, you know, I remember I had a case one time for where a guy had lost, I'm putting that in finger quotes, lost $100,000, which is a lot of money. It's kind of like, how do you lose that? But just to go through it, just looking for something, and I'm not even sure what I'm looking for, I don't do that. I will tell the client, you go through them, because you're in a better position to know if there's something odd.
I think that's a good idea. You know, when we talk about self-employed people, it is a different issue because, you know, if you go to a pizza parlor, parking lot, and there's a lot of cash, that's a different issue. But that's where I'd usually use a forensic accountant if we needed to look at what's the real income and where's the money. But you can't find the money buried in the yard. That's one of the realities of life.
Well, you know, unfortunately, so many people think that there's hidden money somewhere, and most of the time there isn't. You know, that's because there's a lack of trust, that people just don't trust each other, that they're convinced that there's a stash somewhere. But I think most of the time there isn't.
I once had the clients who were, actually they had a car lot. Parking lot, and they did have cash in the basement. They had bricks of money in the basement, and they were both whispering about the bricks of money. They both know it, because people who live on cash spend cash at restaurants, right? So both of them, people know how their lifestyle is. Most people who have W-2 jobs are not dealing with a lot of cash. It's a whole different world. So I do a lot of training for people who are entering the mediation field. I teach in the New Jersey Association Professional Mediators class. I run that class, and I have a lot of guest speakers, and I teach in the ICL class. And so there are a lot of people who are now interested in becoming mediators or adding mediation to their legal practice, their mental health practice. And that's something I encourage, whether or not you're going to do it. The skills in mediation can be very helpful in any field, really, that people work in. And so I'm encouraging people, the training is not long. It's a 40-hour class. And for some people, it can change their lives. And for others, it's something that can be helpful, even in getting your kid to, eat their breakfast in the morning or, clean their room. There are skills that you learn in mediation that you can apply. What would it take for you to clean your room? What do you need to do that rather than making it an order? There are ways to mediate an issue that can be surprisingly positive outcomes.
Well, when you get new clients coming in and they're about to do their first mediation session, how do you tell them to prepare for that?
So it's an interesting thing. The first mediation session is probably for them the most stressful, right? Because they're going from a couple and in a marriage. And the minute they step into the mediation room, whether it's on Zoom or in person, there's an acknowledgement that we're now moving to a different phase of our relationship. That is, we're ending the marriage and we'll be co-parents, or if you don't have children, then we're going our separate ways. So for me, the first session is important in goal setting. What are your goals for this? What do you want life to look like in 2 years? I'm not dissecting their financials, and I tell them, don't worry about that. Just come to the first session. Set the threshold low that they're going to come in and not get so scared away that they don't come to the first session. And so that first session is about, what are your goals for this session? How do you see life 2 years from now? Do you want your divorce to be friendly, quick, amicable, fair, right? People say that words. What relationship do you want to have with your former spouse? What relationship do you want to have with your children? What do you want your children to say about how they remember your divorce? How important is it for you when your child graduates from high school that you sit together, that your child doesn't feel a knot in their stomach every time there's a pickup and drop off? So for me, it's really getting those goals before we start dissecting the numbers and putting a parenting plan together.
And is this something you typically do alone with the parties, or do they have attorneys too?
Very rarely do people come to mediation. This is private mediation. I kind of say the soup to nuts process. People are usually just still living in the same house and have just made that decision to divorce or have been sitting on it for a while. So there are no attorneys in the room. I mean, they're welcome to bring an attorney, but that certainly adds to the cost of a process to listen to your clients emote what they feel divorce should look like. So usually if I have attorneys, you involve them at various junctures. For instance, if we have a complex financial case and we put a balance sheet together, I may then say, let's do a five-way meeting with the attorneys so that we can look at various options in dividing this. And so that the clients don't get too wedded to a solution their attorneys, may have wanted input on. But I also do court-ordered mediation. Christina, do you do that 1:40 roster work as well?
I personally don't, but my partner, John Mocklinger, is on the list.
Okay. So that's very different. That is usually attorneys in the room. It is a much more directive process, much more evaluative process. People who are going through that court-ordered mediation have gone through numerous legal aspects of their divorce. They've gone to early settlement panel, and now they're coming. So you're 6 to 9 months into their conflict. At this point, discovery is supposed to be completed. Oftentimes, they're still missing documents, but they're looking for a resolution, because if this doesn't settle, they'll go to intensive case management, but trial is around the corner, and most couples don't have the money for trial, nor do they have the stomach for it. But that's where attorneys usually are there, and they're there to advise their clients along the way, and they can be very helpful to getting to a resolution, providing a sense of reality. We're mediating in the shadow of the law. They're there to advise them, to counsel them, sometimes to dissuade them of notions of how the law works, which we all have this, you know, every state has different laws. You watch television, you get a very different view of family law than actually what happens in New Jersey.
It's true. Yeah. If for anybody watching or listening on our podcast, if you are basing your, what you think your divorce will look like based upon what you see on television, please don't. Cause I just find the media, I was with many things, you know, that's dramatic, it's exaggerated, and I guess the juicy stuff that people want to see are the most high conflict cases on television. But most divorces aren't that way, and most, they don't really have to be that way. So we encourage it, and that's why we encourage people to settle. We try to get to what really is the, like, what is the real thing that is preventing a settlement? Sometimes it's money, but sometimes it's not. You know, sometimes I think you have to dig a little deeper in mediation to kind of understand where both parties are coming from and not necessarily just look at what they're telling you, because there's subtext. Do you know what I mean? Do you feel like that is the case?
Well, I mean, I think that sometimes it's just timing. People aren't ready. Usually the person who initiated the divorce is 6 months ahead of the other person emotionally, and they're ready while the other person's licking their wounds, kind of feeling maybe sometimes betrayed or shocked, but it's taking time for them to digest the information and to try and figure out what they want. And then
And then
the idea is you've got to figure out what, you know, what's most important to you. Is it keeping the home? And is that really realistic? I mean, I see a lot of women specifically who choose or want the marital residence when in fact it's not something that is affordable, or in keeping the home, they may have to forego vacations or some of the other niceties of life for a house that's really too big. It's not the house they would buy now. The question I always ask clients is, if you were shopping for a house today as someone getting divorced, would you buy this house? And if they say no, I'm saying, then why are you keeping this house? Well, it's the house my children grew up in. You know, I don't want to make too many changes. But they end up making kind of poor financial decisions in a, you know, 5,000 square foot home for three, you know, an adult and two children, when they really don't need that much space. So that was the house they aspired to, but it's not realistic now.
Yeah, I see that a lot too. And I've been doing this for 18 years, not as long as you, but I've seen that again and again. And unfortunately, it, you know, I'm going to generalize, it usually is the wife or the primary caretaker for the kids that wants to stay in the house. And it's very important to them, usually relating to the kids and not uprooting them. But I've always said that I feel that the way that the parents approach it is much more important, and the way that they talk about it with the kids is much more important than whether they actually stay in the house or not. You know, the example I think of is, you know, when your kids are really little and they fall, you can either be like, oh my God, are you okay? And like create this, you know, this, all this drama, and they kind of feed off of that. But if you just say, you know, did you fall down and go boom? And, you know, because I actually literally saw mom do that one day, and I was like, that kid didn't even react because the mom didn't react. And I do think that that's sort of what happens. Even when the kids are older, if one of the parents is, you know, really distraught and acting like the world is ending, then I think the kids sort of pick up on that and they think it's ending too. So I think a lot of it depends on the way that the parents are kind of coloring it.
You know, what you're saying is really true. I'll have clients who come in and they're crying and they're distraught and they're telling me they're children are having a hard time with the divorce. And I ask them, are you going to therapy? Are you getting some help? I said, when your children see you're doing better, you'll be surprised how much better they'll be doing. But they're taking their cues from you. And right, you know, that child who falls and the mom is just like, this is the worst thing ever. It's normal to fall. And you pick yourself up and you, you know, take those baby steps and you'll fall again. But if you normalize it, you know, this is what happens, right? You're learning to walk. You will fall.
And you know what? I mean, person. Not to oversimplify things too, but, you know, I really try to, when I talk to my clients, I try to color things with a sense of empowerment. You know, you can let the divorce process crush you and be upset that this is happening, even if it's not what you want, which I totally understand. Or you can come from a place of empowerment, which is, this is happening. There isn't anything that I can do about it. And I'm going to engage in the process and try to come out of this in the best way possible. And it kind of goes back to what you said, you know, talking to the clients about, what do you really want? And I tell them, you don't have to decide today what you want, but think about it. You know, start thinking about what you want your life to look like. And let's see if we can get you there, so that when this is done, you don't feel broken.
Yeah, and getting back to that house, one of my suggestions is just go out with a realtor and look at, you know, some houses in the X amount of range and see what's out there. And people come back surprised and hopeful, because you can't live life in looking in the rearview mirror. You've got to look forward. And part of that is being able to paint a vision. Visioning is really important, because if you don't have a vision, you're just like looking back saying, I had a great, you know, spouse. I had a great house. I had this. We had summer vacations here. And you can't live in the past, but people need time to lick their wounds too. And that's where the timing comes out.
Yeah, I don't mean to minimize that. I know that divorce is excruciating and especially difficult if you're not the one who initiated it. You know, I think you kind of mentioned this earlier, is that it is harder for the person who didn't initiate it, because the person who did initiate, they've already been thinking about this. They've had time to sort of grieve and come to terms with it. They're in a different place psychologically. The person who's just been told that their spouse wants a divorce, you know, they need a little bit of time to sort of come along. They're not in the same place.
But there's a different argument, which is sometimes what I tell my clients, look, it's not your decision, right? It was their decision. They may second and third guess their decision for the rest of their life. Your job is to live your life, right? So if this is what's presented, how do you make the best of your life? And you can't argue someone's made a decision. They're not waffling. So then what do you do? Do you get stuck? It's like your GPS system, make a wrong turn. Do you keep going or do you redirect? And so I think my job is to help them redirect and feel optimistic. There is a life.
Yeah.
Their children are in good health. They're in good health. There's enough money, may not be the same lifestyle they had before, but there's enough. We're working on budgets. You're going to be getting support. You know, you're going to be getting X amount of the marital pot, and you can live your life.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing for people sometimes is just the change. You know, people, whether they're married or not, getting divorced or not, people often have a hard time with change. And divorce is a lot of change, especially if you're the one who didn't initiate it. You kind of feel like all this change is just being thrust upon you. But change can be good too. And I don't know, I think I'm someone maybe who embraces change. So I kind of get bored if things are the same. Not that I think, you know, everyone should run off and get divorced for something exciting to happen in their lives. But yeah, a lot of things are the way that you choose to look at it. There's a lot of Facebook wisdom out there. There's this postcard with these two people on a bus. I don't know if you've seen this. And one is looking out the window and all happy because, you know, he's watching trees and things go by and the sun is shining. And the other one is on the other side looking out a different window where there's just a brick wall. And he's terrified because there's just a brick wall there. And all he really had to do was turn his head and look out the other window to see something much more positive. And I think a lot of times that's what's happening with people that are getting divorced. Whatever the big life change is for you, it doesn't even have to be that. It could be something else. It is sort of the way that you choose to look at it. You can decide how you're going to come out of it, if you're going to come out better or not.
But you must be a fairly healthy person then. Part of that is your reaction to change. But there are people who are dealing with trauma. They're dealing or reliving their parents' divorces. They're sitting in the room. That's one of the questions I have on an intake form. You know, are you a child of divorce? At what age were you when your parents got divorced? It's one of the most telling questions you can ask, because I often see clients getting divorced and their children the same age they were when their parents got divorced. And so oftentimes I tell them, this isn't your parents' divorce. And we'll talk a little bit about the good and the bad of their parents' divorce and what they're trying to avoid and why it's coming back to them, why their parents' divorce is sitting in the room. It sounds a bit like psychotherapy. It isn't, but it's talking about crafting a different divorce. You know, this is you design your divorce. Let's talk about what you would do differently, and let's incorporate that.
Yeah. And you know, everyone's unique. I mean, you can't expect just because somebody else had an easy divorce or, you know, just, I don't know, read a self-help book and got through it, that that's what your client needs. Or if you're watching this and you're going through a divorce, maybe that's what you need. You got to figure it out on your own. You know, what's going to help you get through this a little better? I always recommend that people get a therapist. We say, don't use your girlfriends or whoever.
Certainly or your lawyer, especially if your lawyer is your therapist.
Don't use them as a therapist. They're not a therapist. They're not qualified to do therapy for you. And they're awfully expensive. So don't use them for that. Find a therapist. Maybe you do need, you know, if there is trauma, maybe you do need to flesh that out. If you're feeling like you're being victimized again. I mean, those are all really important things that come up a lot for people.
Yeah, there are lots of good resources. I mean, I like support groups. My challenge with support groups is you get five different advisors in a support group, and oftentimes people are getting their legal advice, not their moral support from them. So yeah, people should rely on their mediators, their attorneys, but be careful that that Greek chorus who sits on the sidelines and they'll tell you, you know, this happened in my divorce. I get this, people come to me.
Yeah.
You know, my neighbor gets this much in alimony and child support. I said, okay, that's interesting. What are their incomes? What's the parenting schedule? How long was the marriage? And then they'll look at me and I said, well, you know, if you don't have the information, you can't really understand why their amount is different than your amount. And they're like, I don't have that. I said, then you really don't have all the information.
Yeah, you really can't compare your divorce to anyone else's. I mean, there's different people. There's no two divorces that are identical. So just, I always tell people, please don't compare your situation to someone else's, because it might look the same to you, but it's not, just because you're different people.
Right. Very few people are willing to share their marital settlement agreement with you.
So yeah,
you can actually get the details of it, but
That's right.
And then two, people will negotiate differently. People have different needs. So, you know, you really can't predict exactly how two people are going to settle their case. That's one of my challenges is, right, you know, we talked about GPT chat, but it's not just, you know, putting some artificial intelligence in. People have unique needs. There's so many more variables than you can even count in how they come up with a resolution.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to do it. We can't possibly address it today in 30 minutes, but I'd love to have you back on again, Anju, maybe on a day when I'm feeling a little better. But as I say, the show must go on.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, I'm happy and love to come back. It's like sitting in my living room talking to another colleague. So it's a lot of fun.
I'd love to. And for any of you that are interested in learning more about Anju, you can find her online. She is at dwdmediation.org. That's Divorce with Dignity. I will put a link to her website in the comments if you'd like to check her out. And we'll have you on again. Thanks for giving me your time today, Anju.
Thank you. And I hope you feel better. You did great, even with a little bit under the weather. Yeah.
You did the talking. So thank you. I always feel like if I'm talking too much, something's wrong. So
it's the one third, two third rule of interviewing. The interviewer should talk a third of the time, but.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for watching Divorce Happy Hour or listening. If you're listening to us on the podcast, we will see you again with the next show. And don't forget that we go live every Friday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Divorce Happy Half Hour Live. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening. For more information, check out divorcehappyhour.com. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.